Good evening. My name is Jens Meyer-Henrich. I'm a professor in the Department of International Relations here at the LSE. And thank you for joining us this evening. I'm delighted to see as many of you here. And I'm heartened also to see how many of you are interested in engaging with what I tend to think of as the darkest of human phenomena, genocide. The invention of that well-known term, of course, was provoked by the Holocaust, or Shoah. To help us better understand the Nazi genocide, which is sometimes thought of as a unique case of genocide, today's speaker is better qualified than most. For we have with us the, in my humble opinion, leading Holocaust historian of his generation, Professor Dan Stone. Dan is Professor of Modern History at Royal Holloway, University of London, and Director of the Holocaust Research Institute there. He has a stunning list of publications under his belt, among them Histories of the Holocaust, which OUP, Oxford University Press, published in 2010, The Liberation of the Camps, The End of the Holocaust and Its Aftermath, published by Yale in 2015, Concentration Camps, A Very Short Introduction, 2019, published by OUP, and the forthcoming Fate Unknown, Tracing the Missing After World War II and the Holocaust, which Oxford will publish in July of this year. A sought-after speaker, Professor Stone, also advised the Imperial War Museum on its Holocaust galleries, which are a new addition to that important museum in the city of ours. But tonight he will be speaking about his latest book, The Holocaust, An Unfinished History, which Pelican, an imprint of Penguin, released just a couple of weeks ago. Copies are available for purchase from our bookseller, Pages of Hackney, outside of the theater. Professor Stone's book is a marvel of concision and erudition. It is highly accessible, though crammed full of knowledge and insight. The product of a lifetime of learning, the book wears its sophistication lightly, like our speaker, his, as you will see shortly. Destined to become a classic, The Holocaust, An Unfinished History is the best single volume account of the Holocaust I've come across in all my years working on genocide. But don't just take my word for it. Dominic Sandbrook in the Sunday Times called it, quote, a vital history, a, quote, brisk, energetic book that fizzes with ideas. Matthew Rees in The Observer concurred. He praised the book as a timely corrective to the way we see the Holocaust. And just the other day, Jeffrey Weidlinger in the Times Literary Supplement hailed the book as, quote, an outstanding survey, one that upended conventional wisdom about the Nazi genocide, quote, in a thought-provoking way. Some of his thought-provoking ideas, Professor Stone will share with us tonight. Ours is a 90-minute event, and it is being recorded. If you wish to take to Twitter, the hashtag for this event is LSE Holocaust. The remainder is organized as follows. Professor Stone will start us off with 20 minutes worth of opening remarks. At around 7 p.m., he and I will sit down for a more informal conversation about the book. And after about 40 minutes of back and forth, we will hand the floor over to you. Although we will only have time for a couple of questions from the audience, please know this. There'll be time to seek out our speaker afterwards over drinks in the atrium, of which more later. But for now, please join me in welcoming warmly to the LSE, Professor Dan Stone.
The LSE can only afford one mic. It's a shame. Thank you, Jens, and thank you very much to the LSE for the kind invitation to be here tonight, and thank you to the organizers for setting this all up. I hope that this book is not the culmination of a lifetime's work. I think I've hopefully got a few more years to go yet, but we'll see. There are lots of books on the Holocaust. I think everybody here knows that. And it's a perfectly valid question to ask why another one, and what more is there to be said on this subject? And there are a number of answers to that. First of all, let me start with the title, An Unfinished History. What I mean by that is a couple of things. So, first of all, I think that all history is contemporary history in the sense that the questions that we ask are shaped by the age in which we live. So whether you're a historian of the ancient world or the medieval world or the modern period, the things that you're interested in researching are to some extent shaped by the world in which you live, which means that in the old adage, every generation wants to rewrite history, and particularly with topics that remain sensitive, emotionally and politically charged, such as the Holocaust, each generation wants to write a new history of those events. And I think today, writing a book such as this in the wake of the last 10 years of austerity, the climate emergency, the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter, all of these things have shaped the world in a way that makes writing about the Holocaust and other aspects of the recent past different from just 10 or 20 years ago. And so many of the ways I think that we address the topic are also changing. It's also the case, and I think this is really astonishing given the size of the scholarship, the Nazi regime in its 12 years and in the decade before the Nazis came to power in terms of their own writings and so on, left behind an unbelievable amount of material. So the source base is extraordinary for historians in many languages and many places around the world. So I think we'll talk more about that in a minute. But secondly, the Holocaust is unfinished in the sense that, and this is something we definitely will talk about shortly, in the sense that its ramifications and its after effects are still being felt, and in some ways are felt more today than was the case 20, 30, or 40 years ago. The continued production of Holocaust museums, new ones are being built at the moment in Amsterdam, in Bucharest. There's a plan for a major Holocaust museum in Babi Yar, just outside Kiev, if that ever happens. The continued production of Holocaust fiction, films, art, etc. All the ways in which the Holocaust appears in our culture indicate that it is a topic that remains very live, even when it's bowdlerized, attacked, mocked, and so on. It shows that this is a topic that remains crucial to contemporary culture. So there are lots of reasons to write this book, but it's also the case, I think, that the historiography of the Holocaust is in many ways out of kilter with public understanding of the Holocaust. This is something that my late colleague David Cesarani also noticed in his book, Final Solution, and it's something that, together with the Vienna Holocaust Library, the Holocaust Research Institute at Royal Holloway has been trying to address, but of course it's something that we can only do to a fairly small extent. That said, I think we will talk about this as well, problems of commemoration and education and so on. But in terms simply of the scholarship, I think a lot of the complex topics in the history of the Holocaust some often feed through into popular understandings in ways that don't really help us to understand what the Holocaust was entirely all about. And I just want to give a few examples here. So the first is, I think in Western Europe and in the UK in particular, we still very much think about the Holocaust as a story that concerned Germans and Jews. And this, I think, is largely because of the fate of Anne Frank and others like her. The people from Germany There was a large German Jewish refugee community in this country, and the idea that the Holocaust concerned Germans and Jews, I think, remains very common. But the fact is, when we talk about the victims, first of all, the German Jews probably made up no more than 5% of the victims of the Holocaust. The vast majority were Eastern European Jews living in the former Pale of Settlement of the Russian Empire. So the western borderlands of the Soviet Union, Belarus, Ukraine, the Baltic states. And amongst those, the majority, I think, were probably traditional Orthodox religious Jews, poor, living in small towns, but not exclusively. Obviously, the Jews of Eastern Europe was a very large community, divided in all sorts of ways, religiously, politically, and in linguistically, and in all sorts of other ways as well. So it wasn't a homogeneous community, but nevertheless, that's where the majority of the victims came from. More Jews were killed from Warsaw than from the whole of Western Europe. So the focus on the German Jews is only part of the story, and so is the focus on the Germans as perpetrators. And this is one of the things I wanted to focus on very much in this book, that the majority of perpetrators were Germans, by which I also mean Austrians, i.e. Germans in the sense of the Third Reich. I think one of the ways in which the echoes of the Holocaust continue to shape contemporary culture and contemporary debates across the world, and particularly in the former Eastern Bloc of Central and Eastern Europe, concerns the revelations about the fact that not only Germans were perpetrators. And so wherever we look, this is not solely an Eastern European phenomenon, but it takes on a particular piquancy in Eastern Europe for reasons we'll see. Everywhere in Europe, we see collaboration with the Holocaust with the Nazis' project. That collaboration could be at the level of the state, so Axis countries in league with the Third Reich. It could be Nazi movements and parties in occupied countries, for example, the Nationalsammlung in Norway or the NSB in the Netherlands. It can be institutions such as auxiliary police battalions, the OUN, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists in Ukraine, who allied themselves with the Third Reich in the hope of obtaining a Ukrainian state. Police battalions also from Ukraine or the Baltic states, SS regiments from every country across Europe, with the exception of Poland, only because the Poles were not invited to form one. But you know, Albanian SS regiments, Bosnian SS regiments, Flemish SS, etc., etc. This is something we see everywhere, down to the level of individuals, peasants in Eastern Europe who ransacked their Jewish neighbors' homes after they'd been removed from town and shot and murdered, only because their Jewish neighbors might have been marginally less poor than they were, and they could steal a few pots and pans and bedclothes from them. So we see collaboration. It's a very loaded term, obviously, and I think it's a term that comes freighted with baggage from France, where the split between collaboration and resistance means that collaboration carries a certain charge, but it's one that I think is still rescuable in a sense when talking about this phenomenon across the whole of Europe. So we can see this in all sorts of different ways. The reason why that has a particular charge in Eastern Europe is because there we see it's not because the Western Europeans are somehow superior and have dealt with all this. The problem of coming to terms with the past in France or in Belgium or in Italy remains highly problematic. But in Eastern Europe, we have the particular problem of the so-called double genocide narrative. That's to say, countering the emphasis on the Holocaust, particularly since the end of the Cold War, by insisting locally that, okay, the Holocaust took place, the Jews were killed, but then we suffered a 40-year dictatorship and genocide under Stalinist rule. And the problem here with this narrative is not that it's wrong to study the history of communism, of course it's not. What's problematic is the way in which this narrative tends to turn cause and effect on its head, to blame the Jews for bringing communism to whichever country happens to be the case, and suggesting thereby that the Jews, in a sense, deserved their fate under the Nazi regime because they were effectively traitors to their home countries in any case. So this is a very problematic and complicated narrative which surfaces in political discourse, in films, in museums, and in resolutions being debated at the UN and elsewhere across the whole of Eastern Europe, and is, I think, particularly relevant in the Baltic states, in Hungary, and in Romania. So that's, I think, really something to think about. One of the other things that I wanted to try and correct in the book is, I think, in the popular mind, the aligning of the Holocaust with concentration camps. I think this is a real problem because this is actually a large misunderstanding about the history of the Third Reich and about the history of the Holocaust. The regular concentration camp system set up by the SS and administered by the IKL, the Inspectorate of Concentration Camps, had nothing to do with the Holocaust, qua murder of the Jews, except insofar as guards, camp guards for Auschwitz and elsewhere were trained at Dachau, and then later in the war, come back to that. The concentration camps were not established in order to murder the Jews. They were established in the first instance to eradicate the Third Reich's self-declared political enemies, communists, social democrats, and so on, amongst whom there were Jews, and who, as a result of being Jews, were treated particularly badly in those camps in the years before the war. But that's not the first reason why they were there. The next category of people who were targeted for the concentration camps in the mid-30s were so-called asocials in the Third Reich. Beggars, vagrants, prostitutes, gypsies, Roma, who were rounded up and sent to camps. Jews only entered into the concentration camp system in large numbers for the first time after the November pogrom, Kristallnacht, in November 1938. And the men who were then taken to Dachau, Sachsenhausen, and Buchenwald at that point were rapidly released after a month or two on the premise that they would leave the country, which, of course, they didn't really need much encouragement to do at that point. And so I think the reason why we think of Jews or the Holocaust being synonymous with the camp system is because of the end of the Holocaust. The images that we have from the liberation of the camps in Germany proper, particularly from Belsen, Dachau, Buchenwald, Mauthausen, are images of Jews who had arrived at those camps very recently. In some cases, as recently as days or a week or two before those camps were liberated. And where had they come from? They had come from camps further to the east that the SS had evacuated so that the prisoners did not fall alive into the hands of the Soviets. The phenomenon that process describes, the so-called death marches, is one that has also, I think, not been incorporated properly into the synthetic histories of the Third Reich for various reasons. Perhaps it's very hard to write about, it's complicated, the routes that the inmates of the camps took are hard to establish, although there are now sources from the International Tracing Service that help us do that. The strangest thing about them is the fact that of the about 714,000 registered concentration camp inmates at the start of January 1945, about a third of them were dead by the end of the war because they'd been shot en route into the heart of Germany. Or died along the way, effectively the same thing, but murdered either way. And what's so, I think, strange is to try and understand what was happening. If this was the final phase of the Holocaust, as it's been described, well, the Nazis had the resources to shoot everyone if they wanted to, but they didn't. And so trying to understand why they kept some people alive, or only to then dump them in places like Belsen, where there was no food and water, is quite hard and a challenge, I think, to historiography, which tends to work on
rational, empirical presuppositions, and those kind of fall by the wayside when dealing with this topic. Many of those who were still alive, and here's another aspect of the camps that needs, I think, more attention, many of those who were still alive at the end of the war were alive because they'd been housed in one or another sub-camp of the main concentration camps. So the sub-camps, i.e. these small slave labor camps attached to the main camps, had been a feature of the concentration camp system from very early on, and there were groups of camps, such as those, the Operation Tod camps or the Schmelt camps, that performed a particular service with respect to forced labor and so on. But in the summer of 1944, towards the end of the war, the Nazis created a system of approximately 1,000 sub-camps attached to the dozen or so main camps in the Third Reich because of the dire condition of the German war economy. So there were already about 7 million foreign forced laborers in Germany, so people from largely Ukrainians, Russians, Poles, Yugoslavs, Hungarians, but also a number from Western Europe, who'd been rounded up and sent to work in factories, in agriculture, and so on, because all the men had been drafted, the women were already working, and it wasn't enough. The distinction I draw here between forced labor and slave labor is that the forced laborers were civilians who'd been rounded up from other countries and brought to the Third Reich. The slave laborers were concentration camp inmates who were then rented out by the SS to various firms across Germany, and who, of course, were not paid. There was a nominal payment, but that went to the SS, not to the workforce. Both Jews and non-Jews were slave laborers taken from concentration camps to work in these sub-camps. But there were a number of them that were for Jews only. There were a number that were separated by gender. So very interesting, some of the women's camps, like Christianstadt, which was a sub-camp of Gross Rosen, not far from what's today Wrocław or Breslau. And the fact that the Nazis attenuated their racial ideology a little bit towards the end of the war and kept these people alive meant that they were slightly better able physically to withstand the death marches than they otherwise would have been. And they were, in effect, already the dead on leave. That's to say, by forcing them to work as slave laborers, the Nazis had no intention of keeping these people alive indefinitely. It was simply an emergency measure to use them because the war economy demanded it. And had the Allies arrived a few days or a few weeks later at the camps than they did, all of these people would have been dead in any case. But as it happens, those who survived were, I think, those who had been, they were mostly very young, 14 to 30 years old. For the teenagers, they were figured in the Nazi documents as men and women, but actually, of course, were still children. They were among the few who were able to withstand the rigors of the death marches. So you might ask why this matters. I think it matters because, first of all, it's important to get things straight. Secondly, because there's a lot of myth-making about Nazi Germany and about the Holocaust. That pervades the kind of simplistic ways in which we talk about it. And I think after 70 plus years of historiography on this subject, there's, I think, surely room for a more complicated narrative than the one that we've become used to. So a narrative that stresses racial ideology, I think we'll talk more about that shortly, but not in a simplistic sense. A narrative that stresses collaboration across Europe, but doesn't lose sight of the fact that the Germans were the main perpetrators. A narrative that stresses the trauma and the real horror of what happened in the death camps, that gets away from this simplistic notion of industrial genocide, which kind of partly captures what happened in the death camps, but I think also hides as much as it reveals. The real brutality and the violence of what happened in the camps, and a narrative that asks us to think about the neglected aspects of the Holocaust, the death camp, the death marches, the sub camps, the Holocaust in the Eastern European borderlands, and so on. These are things on which there is already a specialist literature, What I've tried to do is to bring them together into an accessible form for general readers. And in that sense, I think that there is, I hope, space for and an appetite for an account that moves us a little bit away from some of the platitudes and some of the simplistic narratives that we've become accustomed to. All right, maybe I should stop there and we can talk some more. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan. And if you're wondering, we've known each other for a couple of years. I'm allowed to call him Dan, or that's all right with you. It's no sign of disrespect. So thank you very much, Dan, for sort of this broad brush overview of the book and what prompted you to sit down and to digest these enormous amounts of knowledge that are out there about the Holocaust, as you just alluded to. When I teach my genocide courses, I tend to begin by telling students that my goal is to diminish certainty on their part, which sounds like a paradoxical goal, but it is prompted by a similar belief that there is perhaps too much conventional wisdom about these instances of mass violence that sort of we have to perhaps first undo. And when I read your book, it struck me that you also, I believe, tend to think that perhaps unlearning the Holocaust, as we know it, is perhaps no less important than learning about it. And I think your lecture brought out this very point, and you came back to it towards the end. Now my question. When did it first dawn on you that, as you put it in the book, and this is a sort of a very strong, provocative sentence, that, quote, we have failed unflinchingly to face the terrible reality of the Holocaust? Was there a moment, an event, a sentiment that caused you to think, you know what, there's an intervention that has to be made, and that then perhaps led eventually to the writing of this book?
I don't think there was a single event, but a sentiment, yes. I've been quite struck ever since the Holocaust has been put on the national curriculum, how when I teach my students, I teach a third year undergraduate course on the history of the Holocaust, and when I meet with the students at the start of the course and ask them, you know, what they think the Holocaust was and what they know about it, they're very nervous. They don't want to say anything because they're worried about speaking out of turn. And I think that's because they've absorbed the notion that from commemoration and so on, that you have to be somber, and they say, oh, you know, it was really bad. And I always have to say, yeah, I know it was really bad. We all agree it was really bad. But we're not going to spend two terms, you know, lighting candles and reciting poems and saying how bad it was. This is a course that is going to investigate analytically and through sources the origins and development of the killing process of the Holocaust. There's a place for commemoration, and the classroom is not it, is my view on that subject. And so I think that the unlearning is a nice way of putting it. I think a lot of students now come with certain presuppositions about the Holocaust. Nazism was mad, this mad ideology that somehow appeared out of nowhere, took over the Germans, that they killed all the Jews because Hitler hated the Jews, and that was it. It was really bad. And even I think, you know, there's a lot of good Holocaust education. I mean, my own children have been to one of the beacon schools of Holocaust education, where a lot of effort is put into teaching this in a sophisticated way. And yet I still think there's a problem then at reaching university, where the students either think, well, we've done this already, or they're a bit worried about what they're allowed and not allowed to say. So I have to say to them, the only thing you're not allowed to say in this classroom is that the Holocaust didn't happen. No, obviously, no Holocaust denial. Other than that, you should feel free to ask anything you like, because, you know, there are no stupid questions when faced with a topic such as this. But that's quite a challenge. And it takes a while, I think, for the students to realize that I mean it.
Yeah. If I could sort of follow up, so what would you say is at stake? So say you hadn't written this book, or this intervention sort of doesn't generate or has the effects that you want it to be, what is lost, or what is at stake of our continuing to view, to talk about, to see the Holocaust
many of us, according to you, also have for so many years. Like, why is it important to rethink, to unlearn?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, within in scholarship and in certainly in history, that's what we do. I mean, revision is part of what historians do all the time, and we want to produce all the time the most, at any moment in time, the most accurate and persuasive account of the past that we can offer. And so there's a kind of paradox. People, I think, sometimes look at the historiography of the Holocaust and see that it's so enormous and think, you know, why do we need more books? But it's precisely on the events that exercise us the most that there's so much production. The books on the topics for which there's a very small historiography are the ones not where the perfect book has been written, and we don't need another book, but topics where we're not so bothered by them anymore. And so, yes, there are lots of books, but that's a sign of the fact that this is an important topic. So what's at stake is, first of all, producing good narratives and good explanations for the thing that we're talking about. But secondly, and I guess this is a more contemporary concern, is that if students think that, say, Nazism came from nowhere, and this kind of madness overtook Germany in 1933, a bit like, you know, in Kurt Vonnegut's Breakfast of Champions, he describes how the German flag changed in 1933. He says the Germans got ill, and then their flag looked like this, and he draws the swastika. And then he says, in 1945, the Germans got better again, and then their flag looked like this, and he draws the, you know, the tricolour of the West German state. And that's kind of, if that's what we think, then it doesn't really leave you able to address similar issues in the present. We live in an age currently where we witness a fight against the populist right, against the rise of fascism in various parts of the world. And if your view of fascism is that it's not as bad as Nazism. Nazism is this crazy ideology that can never really happen again. It just sort of infected the Germans for some reason. Then you're very poorly equipped for understanding the contemporary world, I think.
You mentioned earlier something about education that I want to come back to perhaps later, but let me perhaps pick up another thread in the book. You alluded to it already in your opening remarks, and you, like a couple of other scholars, historians of the Holocaust, make a case for thinking of it as a global event. Interestingly, not all reviewers of your book quite picked up on this strand in the book. For example, Bill Niven's review in History Today was titled, and this may not have been his choice, it appeared under the headline, Continental Shame, the Holocaust as European History. And if I read the book correctly, I think you're saying, well, this is precisely an example of the way in which we are beholden to certain misrepresentations, because I think, I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on sort of that theme of the Holocaust as a global event, and then to what the promise and the limits are of seeing it in this sort of altered fashion.
It's an interesting point. I mean, first of all, it's not wrong, I think, to talk about continental shame, but it's also not quite adequate. That, I think, is the issue. You mentioned the History Today, but the book was also the subject of a two-page, what should we call it? I don't know, two-page discussion, not analysis, that's too grand, a two-page summary in the Daily Mail, which was very interesting because it turned the book into Daily Mail speak. But I felt it'd been done in a really, it's quite a clever thing to be able to do. But the focus of the piece was on the extent of collaboration across Europe. And on the one hand, you couldn't say that this piece misrepresented what I'd argued in the book, but the thrust of it was, I think, for the Daily Mail reader, look at all these crazy foreigners. It wasn't just the Germans. All these other Europeans are also equally mad. And that was really interesting to see. But I think you're right in that it only goes so far in terms of grappling with what I'm trying to say. So when I argue that the Holocaust is global history, I think, I mean, first of all, in the 1930s, when you look at the history of
Jewish refugees from Third Reich and then from the Sudetenland and the Protectorate and so on, you see Jews ending up in Mauritius, in Bolivia, in Shanghai, and all kind of far-flung places across the world. I think places which for most of those refugees were no more than names on a map, and they often ended up in kind of, I think, bemused and thinking, how on earth did I get here? What's going on? There were approximately 250,000 Polish Jews who spent the war years as refugees in the interior of the Soviet Union, because after the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, many Jews fled to the Soviet side of the line and were then deported by the Soviets into the interior of Russia, which for them was terrifying, but which actually saved their lives in the long run. And so whilst those Polish Jews faced immense hardship in the Soviet Union and lots lost their lives and so on, nevertheless, the majority of them ended up in Central Asia, in Kazakhstan, and so on, or in Siberia. And so this is also a kind of worldwide effect of the Holocaust. But we also see, and this is the subject of some interesting recent work, the Holocaust taking place in is maybe a bit too grand, but the Holocaust affecting North Africa, the former French colonies, now occupied by the Germans or the Italians, and you see to some extent Jews being persecuted in North Africa, a small number being deported to the mainland and killed, and also Jews of North African descent in metropolitan France also deported and murdered. And when it comes to understanding the response of the Allies, the churches, the neutral countries, and so on, the Holocaust quite clearly then becomes a case of, I think, of global history. And we can take that through into the post-war period, where when we look at the DP camps and the response of the international community after the war, the creation of the architecture of human rights, the Refugee Convention, the Genocide Convention, and so on, all of these things are connected to the Holocaust and its aftermath, and are all big discussions in the early Cold War.
Right, and even today, so I mean, the trope of the Holocaust obviously is sort of pervasive, and as you indicated, informed the formation, deformation of international criminal law. It's there. But interestingly, maybe I can tag onto this a question about endings. I'm very interested in how genocides end, and not so much in terms of, you know, intervention or not intervention, that kind of focus. It's more like, well, do they really end when they think they ended? Do they really end when, for example, camps are liberated? And I think what I hear you saying in between the lines is perhaps that, well, maybe there's time and scope for thinking about endings differently. Endings not in the sense that, you know, when does industrial or amateur or other kind of killings end, but actually that perhaps these events are continuing into the present. And we have, in a way, a parallel debate right now going on around the world about colonialism and the endings or not of colonial regimes. And I think there is perhaps some parallelity here. Mm-hmm. And sort of, so would you say, or if I hear you, maybe I'm not hearing you correctly, but would you say perhaps that one way of thinking about the Holocaust is to say, you know what, it actually hasn't ended. Mm-hmm. Yes, the killings have ended a long time ago, but the thing, this phenomenon, the event, if we take into account the trauma, the consequences, the diffusion, these global long-term consequences, maybe there's a case to be made to completely rethink sort of beginnings and endings about events like the Holocaust.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I say in the book that the Holocaust did not just end in 1945, and I didn't mean that in a kind of mystical way. It obviously can be made to sound rather obtuse, but what I meant was that the effects of the Holocaust shaped the post-war world in the ways we've just discussed. For example, it continued to shape the lives of survivors, obviously, who the majority of whom were ill, both physically and mentally, in the short term, and in many cases for the rest of their lives, even if they became resilient individuals who, you know, rebuilt their lives and so on. It continued and continues to shape perpetrator societies. I think this is very problematic in the, well, you know, Hannah Arendt said at one point in one of her famous interviews that with Auschwitz, something happened that should not have happened, which sounds very simple, but actually, you know, she's saying here, human beings did something that should never really have been done. And yet that now exists as a point of reference in European and world history. And I think one of the problems we see today in with the rise of fascism across the world is that Nazism provides a kind of an energy, an aesthetic, a style, a vocabulary that people find appealing in moments of crisis. And in that sense, the Holocaust has not ended. And that attraction of fascism remains present, certainly, across the world. That the attractions of violence are common, as you know better than me, in cases of genocide beyond the Holocaust. But I think the particular appeal of Nazism, which has this kind of seductive, apocalyptic quality to it, is one that is very hard. You can't explain it away rationally. You simply have to create conditions where people do not want it. But it's there now as part of the background to our lives. And that's a serious problem. But of course, the Holocaust did not end for its victims in May 1945. When you look at the survivors, most of those from Western Europe, the small numbers who survived from the Dutch or French Jews, were able to return home, albeit circuitously and slowly, but they were able to go home. The majority of survivors were from Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, and were not able to go home, ended up in DP camps in Germany and Austria and to a smaller extent in Italy. The knee-jerk Zionism that developed amongst them saw them try to get through the underground routes, the Bricha, to Palestine, intercepted by the British, interned again in camps on Cyprus, what the survivors called concentration camps, because it was good propaganda. I mean, they were not, but they were obviously being held against their will by the British on Cyprus. And so the apocalyptic quality of Israeli politics, which we see very clearly at the moment, still has something to do with the fact that society was largely created by Holocaust survivors. It's not a coincidence, I think, that Middle Eastern politics is so so frantic, because a lot of this comes from this period. Israel is a country in which Holocaust survivors and the Holocaust made an important impact, and the Palestinians, as Edward Said always used to say, are the victims of the victims of European history. And so the various traumas circulating in that formulation are very striking. So the surviving victims of the Holocaust were often not just the sole survivors of their families, but of their towns, desperately existentially lonely people who, and the United Nations teams across care teams across Europe commented on this, people who would, at the drop of a hat, irrespective of how ill they were, find a way to travel across Europe if they heard the slightest rumor that a relative had survived. And this was actually extraordinary, you know, but people who worked in the DP camps from the Allies or the charities from Britain or the US had to have a permit just to go to the next town. And the logistics of doing so in post-war conditions, where it was hard to get your hands on a car or petrol or train ticket, were very complicated, but the survivors found ways of doing it. And I've looked at cases in my next book, in Fate Unknown, I've looked at cases of teenagers who were in DP camps in Germany in the autumn of 1945, who traveled somehow to Romania to look for traces of their parents and returned again. And you think, how? it's really remarkable. So no, the Holocaust didn't just end in 1945, and in many ways there are all sorts of ways, from historical commissions to debates about migration to debates about culture in the broad sense, to whether we interpret the attack on the Capitol in Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago as a fascist insurrection or not, as after effects of the Holocaust. So I think it continues to shape our world in many, many ways.
Mm. I want to pick up on one sort of aspect of what you just said. And maybe for the audience, one thing that I always cherish about Dan's work, and here he is also unique, is that even though he's trained as a historian and he self-identifies as a historian, unlike most of that profession, he is acutely in touch with social theory as well. He's a very abstract, theoretically driven historian. And like I said in my opening remarks, he wears this knowledge lightly. So he writes accessibly, but there's an undercurrent of theoretical reasoning. And what I want to get at is, when I heard you talk about the displaced persons, the DP camps, and I want to say a few more things. But one thing I heard you also say, or reminded me of this notion that my students are familiar with, because I exposed them to it, is this notion of social death. And social death, interestingly, is a term coined by an African-American sociologist at Harvard, Orlando Patterson, in a book about slavery. Now, Claudia Card, a philosopher, since you mentioned also philosophy, Claudia Card, a feminist philosopher, a couple of years later, discovered this term and used it to describe what she considers to be the essence of genocide. That the essence of genocide is not so much the physical destruction that is part of it, but it's something else that goes deeper. And in a way, that brings me back to what you said about the aftermath of the Holocaust as well. And I wonder if you could perhaps could talk more about Fate Unknown, the book I mentioned that OUP will publish in July of this year, because I think what that book, and there's glimpses of this story in this book, but what that book does and your accounts of displaced persons in this particular book we are launching today is that you are able to bring sort of theory and narrative together. You talk just now very eloquently about the personal journeys and fates and experience of suffering in the aftermath, but you do it also while weaving into that narrative very sophisticated insight, and that's what made me think of Claudia Card. And I think I wonder if you can sort of say a few more things about that Fate Unknown. What prompted you to then, after having written a book about the liberation of the Nazi concentration camps, then to say, okay, you know what? This is part of the unfinished history. This story hasn't really been told. This chapter hasn't been written at all. And this is sort of where you also bring your archival work into it. I wonder if you want to say a few more words about that project. And sort of
Yes, thank you. I'd like to. But first, I mean, to come back to Claudia Card, what she says is interesting, I think, about social death. And I think it relates to quote her again, Hannah Arendt, saying in a letter to her mentor, Carl Jaspers, she said at one point, I quote it in here in a footnotes. She says that perhaps what is behind it all is only that individual human beings did not kill other individual human beings for human reasons, but that an organized attempt was made to eradicate the existence of the human being. And that's something that Arendt wrote to Jaspers in the context of the Nuremberg trials, so in 1946. And it's always fascinated me, because what I think she means by it is not that the Nazis tried to do away with human beings as such, but what they tried to do was, it was an anthropological project to redefine who counted as a human being. And by removing the Jews, to make the human species look as if the Jews had never existed and were never part of the human being. And I think what's so, and there I think she shares some similarities with Raphael Lemkin, the coiner of the term genocide, because his, I think, philosophical insight into what's important about genocide and what distinguishes it, let's say, from crimes against humanity or war crimes, is that it's an attempt to make the world look as if a particular group had never existed. And that matters because we are supposed to believe in plurality and the value of human plurality. And this, the Nazi hubris of trying to decide who did and did not have the right to inhabit the earth, as Arendt also put it in her book on Eichmann, is an extraordinary transgression in terms of ordinary, you know, decent human values. So I think that's what Claudia Card says is a kind of echo of what Hannah Arendt has to say. And I know it comes from Patterson and from the history of slavery, and that's also not irrelevant, the links there as well. So with Fate Unknown, there are some, as you say, glimpses of the book in there, but the immediate impetus for that book, and here's a good example of what's meant by unfinished histories, was the opening of the International Tracing Service archive. So if, for those of you who haven't heard of it, the physical archive is today located in Bad Arolsen in Hesse in central Germany, where it's been located since 1946, and has been known as the International Tracing Service since the start of 1948, although the Allies set it up a few years earlier. It was initially known as the Central Tracing Bureau, and administered by the United Nations, UNRWA, the UN Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, and then various other bodies, until it was administered eventually by the International Committee of the Red Cross from 1955 until 2008, and was established by the Allies as a tracing service, i.e. helping people find their missing loved ones from World War II. And throughout, particularly the 70s and 80s, the Red Cross ran it as a closed institution. And whenever historians tried to gain access, they said, there's nothing really of interest for you in here. And then in the 90s, under pressure from the US Holocaust Memorial Museum and other institutions, they were finally forced to open up the archive. And it turns out that there's 30 million documents in there, the largest collection of material relating to the history of the Nazi crimes, not just the Holocaust, but the Nazi incarceration sites, prisons, etc., etc. A huge body of literature, more than 25 miles of shelving of documentation. It's incredible to see it in the flesh. Really astonishing. It includes huge amounts of material about the concentration camps, from the concentration camps, and then it includes material from the period of the DP camps, the international bodies that were set up to try and repatriate or resettle Holocaust survivors after the war, the International Refugee Organization, and so on. And it contains a huge number, over 3 million so-called TD files, so tracing and documentation. In other words, every time since the end of the war, somebody has submitted a request to the ITS about a person, the ITS has opened a file on that person. Some of them are very thin, obviously, because often there's no trace of a person. But some of them are rather substantial and contain testimonies and photographs and all sorts of documents. The ITS archive is now digitized and can be accessed here in London at the Wiener Holocaust Library in Russell Square. And some of it is online. A few million of the documents can be found online, but you have to be, I think, quite careful using it because not everything is there, and it's complicated to use it still. But the physical archive is extraordinary. And so what I wanted to do in this book is, I did my best to read the 30 million documents and got through some of them. And what I tried to do is partly to write an institutional history, so that's there in the book, because the ITS is also bound up with the history of the Cold War and debates between the Allies about what to do with similar institutions. But mainly to show how you can use the material that's in this archive to write a different sort of history of the Holocaust. So you can use the archive to follow the trajectories of Holocaust victims through different camps, primarily the camps in Germany proper. There isn't very much in the archive about the so-called Holocaust by bullets, the Einsatzgruppen shootings in Eastern Europe, or about the Reinhard camps, Belzec, Sobibor, Treblinka. There's a bit, but not very much. There's not very much about the Holocaust in Romania, say. Again, there's a little bit, but not a huge amount. But vast amounts of information about the main concentration camp system. You can follow the journeys of people, usually using Nazi documents, but you can kind of repurpose them so it becomes more about the victim's own experiences rather than an official top-down Nazi history of what's happening to these people. So there are chapters there in the book about the subcamps and about slave labor, about the death marches and liberation, about the DP camps, about the medical care of DPs, and I think a particular a chapter that was perhaps the most interesting and the toughest to write, there's a chapter on children, because the ITS also established a separate child search branch, which from 1945 until 1950, when it merged with the main ITS. And it, the case files that it holds are really extraordinary. And again, the majority of them are very thin, often one page with NF written on it, not found, no trace of a child. But in the case of the surprisingly large number of unaccompanied children who were found in Europe after 1945, a small percentage of them Jewish, most Jewish children in Nazi-occupied Europe were murdered, but there were some Jewish children amongst them. But the unaccompanied children found in Germany and Central Europe after the war, plus the tracing requests submitted by people looking for their children who were missing, add up to a body of sources that is highly moving and tells you also, again, a great deal about the circumstances after the war. And what you say about social death going to the heart of genocide, I think is right. But I wanted also in this book, not in the manner of saying the Holocaust ended in 1945 and everything is okay, but I wanted to push against a little bit the narrative that Nazism destroyed everything. And particularly today, and particularly in Britain after Brexit, I wanted to say, here with the example of the ITS, we see an institution set up by the Allies, including the British, who in the very straitened circumstances of 1945 devoted resources to helping people in Europe find their loved ones. And although you can find all sorts of miserly comments on the margins of documents in the National Archives written by British civil servants saying, why do we need this? Nevertheless, they continue to fund it and still continue to fund it. And what you see in the ITS is an attempt to repair, to even a minor extent, the crimes of the Nazis. And that, I think, is also an important part of the post-war story.
Very interesting. And if I could just take you back to the crimes of the Nazis. One, and you mentioned Romania in passing. Now, this may not be entirely obvious to all in the audience, but what I learned a lot about Romania, and I happen to know also that quite a while ago you took up learning Romanian. You invested a lot of efforts into learning Romanian, because you identified that particular country as one that also had been underexplored in the many different histories of the Holocaust out there. We know a fair amount about Hungary, about Poland, whereas Romania. So I wonder whether you could sort of speak about that, but also more broadly, how come, why is it that certain countries garner our attention, whereas other countries or experiences fall by the wayside? Like, how do you account for that imbalance?
It's a hard question. I mean, I think the imbalance stems from partly from what sources were available. So the backbone of Holocaust historiography was for many decades, and probably still is to some extent, the documents collated for the Nuremberg trials. And those mostly concern actions carried out by the Third Reich. And the policies of genocide committed by the Third Reich's allies received less attention there. In the context of the Cold War, what happened in the countries behind the Iron Curtain during the Holocaust was the subject of interest among specialists only, area specialists. It was really quite unusual. And that included also, an unusual example is Greece, I think, which of course is Western Europe, but actually physically not, and which, because of its own complicated post-war history of civil war and authoritarian regimes and so on, also failed to address its past in with respect to the Holocaust. And I mean, I got into a bit of trouble a few years ago at a conference in Thessaloniki, where I stood up and, after listening to some of the local historians talking about the research that they'd done, and said that the historiography of the Holocaust in Greece was behind the former communist countries, and people kind of tutted a bit at me. But I thought, it's true. And why is that? And I think it has to do with local myth-making, particularly in Thessaloniki or Salonika, which is where the vast majority of the Greek Jews came from, the ways in which the local non-Jewish community benefited from the theft of the Jews meant that there was a shared silence. Everybody knew, but nobody would talk about it. And so there was no literature on the subject. In the communist countries, it was different, that one was allowed to write about the Holocaust, but only in a certain circumscribed way, with a typical, you know, with the Marxist-Leninist vocabulary and framework. Nazism, as the tool of big business and so on, which didn't really help in explaining the Holocaust. And the case of Romania in particular, because of Romania's own post-war communist history, which particularly by the time Ceausescu came to power, was drifting more and more towards what Norman Mania, the exiled Romanian writer, calls national socialism pure and simple. So Romania had a very tiny indigenous communist movement before the wars. It was a country massively dominated by ethno-nationalism and anti-Semitism, a largely illiterate country still until the end of World War II. And one of the ways in which the communist regime, particularly under Ceausescu, ingratiated itself with the local population was by encouraging the similar Iron Guardist ideas about the links between religion and the Jews that had been characteristic of Romanian fascism during the war. And so in official Romanian discourse, the Holocaust in Romania meant the deportation of the Jews from northern Transylvania by the Hungarians. So whenever the Holocaust, because the northern Transylvania was returned to Romania after World War II, having been given by Hitler to the Hungarians after the Second Vienna Award in 1940. So it was very easy for the Romanian regime to say, oh yes, Holocaust in Romania, that means the Horthyite fascist barbarians, and completely to neglect the fact that the Antonescu regime had itself been responsible for the murder of somewhere in the region of 300,000 to 350,000 Jews, those deported from Bessarabia and Bukovina in Greater Romania to the area of Ukraine between the rivers Dniester and Bug that the Romanians called Transnistria, not to be confused with Transnistria today, the breakaway region in Moldova, which is historically Bessarabia. So the combination of the Jews taken from Bessarabia and Bukovina and the local Jews in Transnistria meant that the Romanians in 1941, 42 were responsible for killing huge numbers of Jews and a smaller number, several tens of thousands of Roma as well, who were deported from Romania to Transnistria. But the Antonescu regime from the autumn of 1942 onwards then did a volte-face, and the vast majority of the Jews from the Regat, the old kingdom of Romania, particularly the Jews of Bucharest, were not deported, and the Jews of the Banat, so in the western Romania, centered around Timișoara, the Jews were also not deported. So at the end of the war, Romania had the largest Jewish community in Europe. And a bit like, but on a much grander scale, in Spain under Franco, you see this myth of Franco being becoming the savior of the Jews during World War II. And in Romania, though much more egregiously, you see not Antonescu himself, because he was executed as a war criminal, but some of the other surviving members of his cabinet publishing books with titles like I Saved the Jews, Radu Leca's book, I Saved the Jews. And you think, yes, you did, but also you killed a lot of them first. And that bit got missed out of the narrative. So I think what happened in Romania is, I think, very little known, still in the English-speaking world. The places in Transnistria, today Ukraine, where massacres, some of the largest massacres of the Holocaust took place, committed not by the Germans, but by Romanians with local Ukrainian help, have no resonance in English, in the English-speaking world. Bogdanovka, Domanevka, Akhmechetka, Pechora, these are places that no one's heard of, and yet what happened there is really extraordinary, and I'm going to write more about it, I think.
Terrific. Maybe I ask you one more question before we hand things over to our audience. And I've sort of changed tack a little bit, and you, in the book, present an argument for, if you will, bringing ideology back in. You're suggesting that perhaps in some other more recent scholarly accounts, there was insufficient attention paid to the role of anti-Semitism in particular, but also to what you call in the book and sort of race thinking. Mm-hmm. You want us to think about ideology, I believe, but also to think about ideology with and beyond anti-Semitism. Now, seeing that in this country, of course, the Labour Party in particular has been wrestling with sort of the meaning, the understanding of anti-Semitism and its relationship to racism and race thinking, I wonder if you could sort of shed light on this complex set of issues through the lens of the Holocaust and sort of your scholarship.
I can try briefly. I mean, I think there's a large history of literature on whether anti-Semitism is or is not a variety of racism. And I want to say simply that it is. It's not the same as white racism, for example, because the content is different. The majority of white racism towards black people is based on colonialist and pre-colonialist notions of racial superiority and inferiority, spurious notions of human evolution and so on. Whereas anti-Semitism, particularly in its modern variant, is less about the supposed inferiority of the Jews driven by skin color or other physical characteristics, and more about a kind of fear of the Jews, of their hidden power. And certainly in Nazism, anti-Semitism, you can find both. You can find racial varieties of anti-Semitism based on attempts to measure Jews and all sorts of anthropometric measurements and biometric measurements. But fundamentally, I think for the Nazis, anti-Semitism was a paranoid racial conspiracy theory. And it was racial only in the sense that its basic premise was that the Jews couldn't help behaving in this way because this was an innate characteristic that the Jews shared. But in other respects, it had nothing really very much to do with race in the sense of race science. So I think another misunderstanding that's quite common about the Holocaust is that it was an outgrowth of Nazi eugenics. Actually, I think Nazi eugenics helps us much better to explain the euthanasia program, the murder of mostly Aryan Germans in the Third Reich, spuriously understood as innately disabled or people suffering from acute alcoholism, for example, murdered because of some notion that they were hereditarily sick. It helps also to explain the attack on asocials and other minority groups in the Third Reich. And whilst there are connections between the euthanasia program and the murder of the Jews in terms of the use of gas chambers, the personnel that were transferred from the euthanasia program to the Reinhard camps, there was a separate track of the history of anti-Semitism. I think they came together in a contingent way at a certain point in time, 1940-41. But the history of anti-Semitism in Nazi Germany that preceded that point tells you that the attack on the Jews has a different trajectory, I think. And why I don't talk solely about anti-Semitism, however, is because I think that you can't understand the Third Reich without seeing it as, you know, what Berlin and Wippermann called many years ago now, a racial state. And that term has been subjected to a lot of intense criticism in recent years, but I think fundamentally it still stands, that what really distinguishes the Third Reich from even people who are quite obsessed with anti-Semitism, like Antonescu or Horthy in Hungary to some extent, or Pavelic in Croatia, Tiso in Slovakia, is that the Nazis placed race thinking at the heart of the state and made it the lens through which they understood the world as such. Everything was seen through those racialized lenses. So the attack on the Jews was not simply one bit of the Nazis' broader program. It was the Nazis' program because the Nazis understood the Jews to be a world historical, a kind of metaphysical enemy that had to be eradicated if the Aryan race was to flourish. And so this is race thinking that goes beyond an anti-Semitism that is purely a hatred of Jews. It's about a racialized understanding of the world as such. And I quote, there's one thinker in the book, Eric Fergelin, who coined the term also political religions in 1938, 39, who describes Nazism as a system of scientific superstition. I think it's absolutely brilliant that he shows how, for all its scientific pretensions, and for all the fact that many scientists, anthropologists, geneticists, biologists, serologists, and so on, threw in their lot with the Nazis, nevertheless, the fundamental premise of Nazism had nothing to do with science. It was something that the Nazis wanted to believe, and found ways of using science and other discourses to back up something that they already believed, not the other way around. And that, I think, is very important for understanding the place of anti-Semitism and race thinking as such in Nazi Germany.
Fascinating. On that note, I am happy to take questions from the audience. There's mics going around, and if you would just wait for the mic to reach you. And before speaking, if you wouldn't mind identifying yourself and telling us your affiliation to the extent that you have. Yes, in the back. I think the mic may not be working. Could that be?
I can hear you.
Go for it, yeah. Our mic, because there's sort of some feedback going on that is not. Would you mind just using our mic from here? Because for the recording as well, that might be easier if that's all right. Sorry to trouble you.
That's all right. Stretch my legs.
Yes.
Sorry, does that work?
Yeah. Yes, you mentioned this sort of circuitous route that the Nazis took towards the Jewish question, and you touched on some of the kind of correctives about the journey towards the Holocaust, i.e. the concentration camps were originally to solve German societal problems, or at least in the Nazis' mind. I mean, that's a horrible euphemism. Mm. I think you know what I mean. And then the drift in towards, you know, creating the death camps and the extermination policy. Now, many moons ago, when I was sort of doing this sort of stuff at university, decades ago, sadly, there was a lot of focus around the Wannsee Declaration and this great debate towards, at the time, at least to the extent to which these Nazi decisions were either the monolithic top-down, mm-hmm. or there was a sense of a sort of chaos, mm-hmm. and even the extent to which the Holocaust sort of accelerated or happened as a product of almost failure in the war aims, this fear of the destruction of the German and Nazi regime, and this kind of bitterness that if Germany, racial Germany, is going to be brought down, then we're going to bring down, you know, our racial enemies at the same time. And then the last, and I wonder to what extent that, you know, that historiography has moved on from my sort of fossilized period of study many moons ago, and the extent to which, where you touched on at the end, that things sort of seem to have moved back from extermination to actually, crikey, we're losing so much, we need to actually use some of these people again, and we'll hold off on killing them. Mm-hmm. And to what extent any of this was chaotic, driven from the top, how the role of Wannsee, I don't know to what extent, those sorts of issues, I'm just interested to get a fresh perspective. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. There's a lot in that.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. But it's several very big questions. Let me just say, I mean, with respect to the subcamps, I would say that yes, it was kind of chaotic, but it was top down. I mean, this was a policy driven by the SS's business administration main office, the WVHA, under Oswald Pohl, and the policy was deliberately constructed. So because the Germans were desperate for manpower, and so the decision was made to use Jews from concentration camps in the manner that had already been the case in the Łódź ghetto, for example, from 1940 through to the summer of 1944, and to say, okay, we need more people, so we'll, these people are there, let's give them, they don't talk about it in these terms, they don't talk about giving them a temporary reprieve, but that's effectively what happened. But yes, it is chaotic, because although they make that decision, there are actually very few people amongst the SS hierarchy who we would regard as having anything like a kind of modern managerial attitude towards their workforce. So obviously, if you're interested in productivity, you might generally choose to feed and house your workforce properly. And this is not something that the Nazis choose to do, on the assumption that the Jews are replaceable. There'll always be some more from somewhere that they can get. It's not necessarily the case towards the end of the war, but that's their basic thinking. Jews are people to be killed, and so actually most of these subcamps don't really achieve anything meaningful in terms of production. Wannsee I can deal with quite quickly. So what you were talking about, obviously you remember the old debates between intentionalists and functionalists, right? And for most people here probably, I think, know what those are. The schools of historiography which divide between those who think that the Nazis killed the Jews because it was always Hitler's intention to do so, and the functionalists who, on the other hand, say the Holocaust evolved in a more ad hoc way, driven by contingent circumstances, the military situation, for example, or power struggles between different agencies within the Third Reich. Wannsee was a really important event in January 1942, but it cannot have been, as the old intentionalist argument suggested, where the decision for the final solution was taken. In a sense, that undermined the very premise of the intentionist argument from the start, because if Hitler had always intended to kill the Jews, why did they need to hold the Wannsee conference to make a decision to kill the Jews, right? So it's not logical. What Wannsee did, I think Mark Roseman shows this most brilliantly in his little book on the subject, Wannsee was the moment when the Nazi power struggle with respect to who was to take charge of Judenpolitik or Jewish policy in the Third Reich was effectively ended, where Heydrich stood up and said, this is the SS's job now. Because previously, officially still until July 1941, Göring had been responsible for the Jewish policy. But the SS was steadily asserting itself. And this is one of the few occasions where I think we can understand history through film. And if you've ever seen the film Conspiracy, which is an extraordinary, it's only 1 hour, it's just a film. It's set in the Wannsee Villa, and it shows the men who attended the Wannsee conference sitting around the table talking. That's all it is. But at one point, they break for lunch, and Heydrich goes for a little walk outside in the snow with Stuckart, maybe? One of the civil servants who's a little bit concerned about simply saying to the SS, yeah, you take charge. And Heydrich, played by Kenneth Branagh, who I can't really see anymore without. I can't think of Heydrich without seeing Kenneth Branagh. Heydrich takes him for a little walk outside and says, yeah, you know, we've got no shortage of meat hooks for those who oppose us. And there's nothing in the historical record to suggest that Heydrich ever said that, but it's also chillingly likely, I think, that something like that happened, because what Wannsee is this moment where not just the Nazi Party agencies, but the state, the agencies that are outside of the state, the civil service, the foreign office, etc., are forced into line, and they're all they're made complicit in the Third Reich and made to say that they will be involved and that they will accept the fact that the SS is in charge of it. So that, I think, is where Wannsee is so crucial. There are also, I mean, actually, if you read the Wannsee protocol, the majority of it is taken up with debating what to do with so-called Mischlinge, so-called mixed race people in the Third Reich, which is another separate history. And also, what it boils down to is the gradual radicalization of policy, so that the possibilities for escaping the Holocaust for those of mixed race become fewer and fewer over time. In general, I would say that the historiography has moved on immensely from those days. I was an undergraduate 30 or so years ago, and those debates about intentionalism, functionalism, etc., were also very pressing. The idea of Nazism as top-down, or Nazism as chaotic polycracy, and so on, those were the things that we debated, and those still exist. You know, intentionism, functionalism hasn't gone away entirely, but what I talk about in this book when I write about ideology is you can read that as a kind of intentionalist argument. I'm trying to make a case for the significance of Nazi ideology, but not ideology in a kind of narrow political party program kind of way, but ideology understood as a Weltanschauung, a worldview that Goebbels talks about Nazism as being the very air that we breathe. I cite him in there. And the idea to reshape people's whole lives so that they are infused with Nazism is what I'm talking about there. So when it comes to the decision-making process for the final solution, the anti-Semitism and the desire to exterminate the Jews is already in the minds of the Nazis as a kind of incipient fantasy from before there's even a blueprint. So it's ideology. I accept the fact that I think basic points of the functionalist argument, that policy developed in an ad hoc way and so on, but I mean, for example, the argument that you refer to, Hans Mommsen, that the Holocaust almost happened by accident because the Germans were worried about losing the war, makes no sense, right? Unless you ask, well, why the Jews? You can say that policy towards the Jews developed in an ad hoc and reactive fascism, fascism on the brain. But you can't. But it doesn't answer the question, why were the Nazis targeting the Jews in the first place? And that's something that we then need to come back to. But beyond that, you know, I think when I was an undergraduate, the debate about the decision-making process for the final solution was the absolute centerpiece of Holocaust historiography. And now it remains important, but it's by no means the only thing that people are writing about. And in the last 20 years, Holocaust historiography has become extremely methodologically diverse, representing the diversity of the historical profession. And the questions and the research projects that are now developed are very, very different from the ones that we studied as undergraduates. Gender history, microhistory, family histories, intersections with cultural geography, with archaeology, with forensic science, with anthropology, with literature, etc. The interest in aftermath issues, the DP camps, the International Tracing Service, the simply understanding the Holocaust from the victim's perspective, as opposed to this fascination with Nazi documents, has overturned much of what we studied 30 years ago. So it's, you would recognize it, but at the same time you'd say, oh, there's a whole load of other stuff as well that's there.
Let's maybe move on sort of to give other people a chance as well to come in and ask questions. And if you don't mind, because there's many hands going up, I take sets of three and maybe we can go through two rounds. In the middle, over here, and then one over here. Yeah, you go first, if you wouldn't mind, and we collect three questions, and then you sort of identify yourself again, tell us who you are, and
is it on?
Your questions brief.
Well, my name's Simone, and I'm halfway through the book. It's bedtime reading. So I was really interested, I've been quite curious about what it does, what it has done for you, what it's been for you to be involved in this particular area, in for you as a person. And then tonight you said ordinary, decent human values. And I couldn't quite resolve that as you said it. So there's a question in there somewhere, but I'd just like you to respond to that maybe. Thank you.
Thank you. And over here next.
Hello. Oh, yes, you can hear me. Hopefully you can hear me. I think I just wanted to just make a quick point that I don't have any problems whatsoever with equating the Holocaust with the death camp system. I do see them as synonymous, so maybe there might be a point of debate between us about emphasis. But I think the industrial killing machine that the concentration camps evolved into is and should remain synonymous with what we really understand mm-hmm. as the principal crime of the Holocaust. But my point, my general point question was really just to, I suppose, praise you for raising the issue of collaboration, because I think if there is an unfinished history of the Holocaust, it is the sheer extent, horrific extent, to which the Nazis were assisted by local populations in their conquered territories throughout Eastern Europe at all levels, from the state level, as you say, right down to ordinary citizens in the actual perpetration of their crimes. And many people, many local populations benefited financially and economically from the death of their Jewish neighbors.
I had one more question over here in the fifth row.
Hello. So I'm an undergraduate here at LSE studying history. And so I was just wondering, I think this is quite in the same vein as the first question you answered, of to what extent is writing a history of the Holocaust to write a history of World War II? And how have you found the historiographies of World War II and the Holocaust both sort of work in tandem, but also diverge?
Great, thank you. Should we take them in order? Because I don't really like to talk about myself as a person, as you put it. Let's just say I think studying the Holocaust for 30 plus years doesn't leave you feeling very optimistic about the human condition, I would say. And with respect to ordinary, decent human values, well, I mean, simply not killing other people, maybe, as a good start. So that's what else can I say? I think that we live in a strange moment in time now, where you know the Home Secretary can give a speech on Holocaust Memorial Day, saying we should never forget the horrors of the Holocaust, and then the next day continue with the attempt to remove this country from the UN Convention on the Rights of the Refugee, etc., etc. And you think, where have the ordinary, decent human values gone? So that's what I mean. I'll take the last question next, I think, because it sort of fits with that, if that's okay. And that's a really interesting question, because it was long a complaint of historians of World War II that they didn't write about the Holocaust. It was quite possible until probably 30 years ago now to pick up a history of the Second World War and for there to be no reference to the Holocaust. And that has completely changed. You will not now find a serious scholarly book about World War II. I'm not a military historian, so I can't speak to this in detail, but you will not find a serious synthetic history of World War II, and probably even many local military histories that do not mention the Holocaust or the way in which the war was intertwined with the Holocaust. And what's interesting, I think, even though that complaint was voiced by Holocaust historians, is that you don't often see the reverse being true either. So not many Holocaust historians know very much about World War II, and I've probably include myself among them. And I think that, you know, one of the achievement of David Cesarani in his last book was to show how the Holocaust was bound up with the military situation. I mean, in a sense, this is obvious. So the Jews of Hungary couldn't be deported until the Germans occupied Hungary. The Jews of Rhodes couldn't be deported until the Germans occupied Rhodes, etc. It's kind of obvious, but it also it helps you to understand the spread of the Holocaust, the scale of it, and also the importance of the extermination of the Jews to the Nazis. Although they were bound by the military situation, they also, everywhere they went, including right up until the end of the war, sought out Jews to be included in the final solution. So the Holocaust in France, for example, is obviously tied up with the military situation. Until the Vichy you know, the unoccupied zone was finally occupied in November 1942. The Jews there couldn't be deported in the way that the Jews of Paris had been up until that point. But things changed after then. And so you see the war shaping the Holocaust, but it's not at all synonymous with it. The war in the East, the so-called War of Annihilation, I think for the Nazis, there was no distinction between the war against the Soviet Union and the war against the Jews. Because of their belief in the notion of Judeo-Bolshevism, the Soviet Union as a Jewish creation. And it was then wrong for military historians to overlook that connection. But that's changed a great deal. And although, if you look at the shelves of Dad history in Waterstones, there are still endless books published on, you know, panzer insignias of World War II and so on, gun barrel diameters. We can overlook that kind of stuff and say, but the serious historiography no longer misses this connection. Your point, thank you for what you said about collaboration, because I think I've tried to be careful in the book to say that it remains the case that the majority of perpetrators were German, but yet, as you say, that without that, the collaboration everywhere across Europe, the murder of the Jews would not have been as successful as it was because of local perpetration. And the case of Salonika, again, of Jews assisting in the rounding, identifying and rounding up and stealing from Jews in the context of the ethnic rivalries of that city, which had become very marked since the fire of 1913, and the incorporation of Salonika into the modern Greek state and so on. Those rivalries had become very intense and have to be understood. The Nazis exacerbated something that was already in train in Salonika in a way. They stepped in and radicalized a process already at work. In Hungary, Eichmann's Sonderkommando in spring of 1914 had something like 200 men. 200 men did not deport 437,000 Jews from Hungary. The Hungarian police did that. The same is true of the French police, the Norwegian police, the Romanian army, etc., etc. So I think you're right. I wouldn't wholly agree with what you say about the death camps system. I think what happened in the Reinhard camps and at Auschwitz was the culmination of the Holocaust. And the death camps at their height in the spring of 1944 in Auschwitz could kill a lot of people very quickly. Nevertheless, only about half of all the Holocaust victims were killed in death camps, and I don't really see any reason why we shouldn't refer to those who were killed in ghettos or those who were shot in face-to-face killings as victims of the Holocaust. So I would certainly say I don't by any means seek to downplay the importance of the death camps in this book, but I do want to say that the Holocaust is not only synonymous with death camps.
Unfortunately, I have to bring this proceeding to an end. I, for one, have learned a great deal from Dan's remarkable book. If you're interested in purchasing copies of it, as mentioned before, our bookseller, Pages of Hackney, has a stall outside. And also, if you want to continue the conversation, or didn't have a chance to pose your question to Dan, there's a reception in the atrium. Just exit and make a left turn, and you will have an opportunity to talk with him. But before you do that, please join me in thanking him warmly for having spent this time with us.